This is an ABC podcast.
Today we visit a state-of-the-art house built not only to the highest bushfire safety standards, but also it costs less than a cup of coffee a day to power.
13.3 kilowatts is what's been calculated to run this whole house a day, which equates to about less than a takeaway cup of coffee. So it's about $3.80 on today's current kilowatt hours.
And the art of teaching young Aboriginal children their language.
I try to tell them, you know, your language is who you are. Before white men arrived here and gave us the title Aborigines, that was a Latin word. We were identified by the language we spoke.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. First up, we're going to head to the gold mining town of Kalgoorlie in Western Australia. It's a town of 29,000 residents, and many people are employed by the mining industry. If you drop into Kalgoorlie Regional Airport on any given day, all you will see is high-vis vests, as every week 4,000 workers fly in for jobs on the mines. And the expectation is that the influx of fly-in, fly-out workers is only going to continue to increase, because there's a skill shortage in Kalgoorlie, a shortage that is looming across mining towns in Australia, with the Peak Mining Body estimating a shortfall of 21,000 workers over the next 5 years. Kieran O'Donnell runs a recruitment firm in Kalgoorlie and is the president of the Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Earlier, he told me it's a return to both the pros and the cons of the mining boom days.
It's quite obvious and well documented that there is a squeeze on labour, skilled labour, predominantly in Kalgoorlie, Boulder, your trades, your engineers. So I'm talking, you know, electrical trades, heavy duty fitters, mining engineers, geotechnical engineers, geologists. And I don't see that getting any better soon. Obviously, with what's predicted in the Pilbara, Queensland projects that are happening, and obviously with how, you know, it's a little bit more difficult to live in regional Australia, as much as I love it. We are going to feel the squeeze, but yeah, we're going to feel the pressure, and we need to start doing things now to get things in place to be able to ride out that storm.
What can you do?
Well, we're doing a lot. I see it every day because obviously I'm in labour hire / recruitment, so people are coming to us daily who actually are just moving here on for whim. I spoke to a guy in Dubbo the other day, just rang our office, and I picked up the phone randomly, and he was a bricklayer over there. He said he can't get enough hours, his hourly rate's terrible, and He just said, I'll fly over there if you can get me a job. And we actually could, because we're actually lucky enough to do a lot of entry-level work. There's a lot of entry-level opportunities in Kalgoorlie-Boulder. So people that come here, we can, if you're drug-free and got a reasonable police clearance and a driver's license and all that, and you're reliable, we can get you an entry-level job into mining. As a national standpoint, a lot of people have a bit of an image of Kalgoorlie-Boulder and the goldfields and how it is to live here, and it's completely wrong. So we're trying to work on our brand and you know, just do things to make the town more livability. That's our big word, is that, you know, we're trying to make the town more livable for people that want to relocate from cities or other parts of regional Australia.
So going back to the chap from Dubbo, is it wages? Is that how you kind of entice somebody in, or is it that it's steady, regular work?
Yeah, wages. It's for Kalgoorlie-Boulder. It's wages. It's lifestyle, and it's, you know, it's got something for everyone. It's not just, you know, young people that want to make a start in mining. It's, you know, I'm raising my family here. My parents raised me here. You know, some of the best beaches in Australia are only 3.5 hours away in Esperance. We've got everything, really. We have direct flights to Melbourne. You know, the town offers everything. But yeah, it the wages is obviously the significant thing. We've got the highest average salary in Australia. It's, you know, some of our entry-level jobs are paying $85,000 a year, and you're working half the year. If you had told me that when I was 16, 17, I would have jumped straight into mining instead of being a cabinet maker in a mining town. That was my silly fault, but so I got a late start. But, you know, you can't tell me that everywhere in Australia you can get a job paying $85,000 to $90,000. Some are $100,000 on a 7-7 roster. So you do a week, and then you get a week off. I'm lucky to have a week off every year.
As a recruiter, do you see wages having those massive hikes that you saw in the, you know, the peak of the boom?
We are, and that's one of the issues. I mean, we don't want to become unrealistic, and people are becoming very unrealistic with their wage expectations, especially what we're finding with your permanent type recruitment, where so you're just, you know, your engineers and not labour hire, it's just direct hire. We're getting people, they're successful, they're doing the interview, doing the medical, but the companies they're working for are throwing the world at them because they can't afford to lose him. You know, we had a surveyor on a mine site that normally requires five. He was the only one left there because of this issue with shortage. And then he took a role with us, and at that, the company then threw like ridiculous things at him. You know, additional support with obviously higher wages, flexible roster, get his partner a job on the mine. Like, you know, so just moving mountains to get these, keep these people, because without them, they are absolutely buggered.
So why aren't more people going for these jobs then? Is it a case of kind of luring people back into the industry that after the last downturn, is it a case of once bitten, twice shy? Is that why people aren't taking them up?
That would be one issue. I do. We speak to people that have gone to Perth, or I know, you know, and I've seen the people move around. Back when the goldfields was booming, I was living here. I moved to the city for work reasons and personal reasons. Then I went to the Pilbara and lived up there for a few years. And I've seen the same people that were I'd worked with in the they'd obviously left the goldfields because that dropped off. Then they've moved to the Pilbara. That dropped off. They've, you know, either come back to Perth or gone back to Kalgoorlie. But one thing I'm finding, a lot of people say, what are these people in Perth that aren't getting, you know, they do 38 hours a week on not the greatest wages, and obviously the lifestyle, you're spending 2 hours a day in your car. Why can't they come to Cal? They've bought houses, and as we know, the Perth house market's not amazing. And I spoke to a guy just the other day, and he just said, look, he actually came to Kalgoorlie. We interviewed him, and he just wanted to get a mock because he just can't get ahead in Perth. But the issue is he can't sell his house because it's gone down $90,000. So, you know, does he rent it out? Does he, if he sells it, he loses money, moves to Kalgoorlie, does he get a rental? There's so many issues. We've got a 1% or 1.5% vacancy rate of rentals in Kalgoorlie-Boulder. That's an issue. So even if people want to come here, they can't get housing. They have to stay in caravan parks. Our hotels are full. They are chockers.
Are you surprised, though? Because you've been in the mining game for a long time. You've grown up in a mining town. So you know the cycle of boom and bust and the way it goes. Are you surprised that we find history repeating itself again? That, you know, back to the same issue, skill shortage, ballooned wages, rents not available, people not being able to move easily with their families. That kind of, it seems to be the same thing all over again.
It is. I don't know who I'm prescribing to say we, but as a whole, the mining industry, government, local government, council, we've missed the boat, and we can't make that same mistake again. I didn't expect it. I was in Labor High when the last sort of boom was on, and then hit the GFC, and I thought, yep, that's the end of those sorts of days. And even 18 months ago, 2 years, people were talking about Kalgoorlie-Boulder and just the mining in general going gangbusters again, and the gold price, you know, people said $2,000 for the gold price, and everyone just laughed at them at Diggers and Dealers, you know, last year and the year prior, and now it got up to $2,300, and I'm hearing things that it's, you know, potentially going to hit $3,000, so it's ridiculous. So we really need to really start looking at apprenticeships, because most of these roles are trades and mobile plant operators. There's a lot of training happening in Kalgoorlie-Boulder that the companies are doing it, but it's not at the numbers that are required. There's the immigrant workers that obviously everyone's looking at with the designated area migration agreement that we've got in place now. I don't see that being the answer at all.
Kyron O'Donnell, the president of the Kalgoorlie-Boulder Chamber of Commerce and Industry and owner of a recruitment firm, High Grade Personnel. Thanks for chatting to Australia Wide.
No, I appreciate you having me, Sinead. Thanks a lot.
For families building new homes, environmental sustainability and protection from natural threats like bushfires is often a trade-off. But now a new state-of-the-art home has achieved the highest bushfire safety and energy efficiency rating under one roof. The build is an Australian first and costs less than a cup of coffee a day to power. Donald Scheel has the story.
So we're now going to cut the ribbon.
When Joe and Marylise Messia started building environmentally friendly homes 15 years ago, they had a lot of critics who said it couldn't be done.
We were told 15, 17 years ago that it just wouldn't work and no one would want it and it's just not the right thing to do and cost-wise and everything else.
All these years later, the couple's now unveiling their latest creation, Australia's first passive house with the highest bushfire safety rating.
So we proved everybody wrong 15, 17 years ago, and now we're doing it again today.
So can you please join me in congratulating these guys?
The display home is based in the Blue Mountains village of Falconbridge, and inside, it's like any other modern house, but it's what's under the hood that makes a difference. Complex system of electric shutters, external cladding, and an airtight ventilation system gives the home its unique dual classification as fire safe and energy efficient, and Joe says powering the entire house per day costs less than a cup of coffee.
13.3 kilowatts is what what's been calculated to run this whole house a day, which equates to about less than a takeaway cup of coffee. So it's about $3.80 on today's current kilowatt hours. So $3.80 a day to run this house without solar. So we've actually put solar on this house so that we can then achieve carbon zero.
Another flagship feature of the build is its air tightness, which not only keeps air clean, but allows the temperature of the home to remain steady year-round, requiring little to no heating or cooling. And Joe says while most homes experience about 15 air changes an hour, this home sees just a fraction of that.
With this house, we had to be 0.6 as a minimum, as a maximum.
To meet
certification. We actually got it down to 0.39. So which we're well below. So that means that in the entire external envelope of the house, we have an 11 millimetre diameter hole. So it's smaller than the pinky finger.
And can you give me an idea as well of the cost of this particular build?
Well, this particular build, because it was our first, we've done a lot of learning and a lot of putting things in, tearing them out because they sort of failed and we weren't happy with them or we could do them better. So there was a fair bit. That probably added about 22% to the build. But we're quite confident that we can get that down to about 15% higher than to today's current standard of building.
So the last few slides, this is just one of my projects, an old house in Lower Mountains. Look at everything you wouldn't want.
Throughout the Blue Mountains region, bushfire preparation is now a fact of life after devastating bushfires in 2013 destroyed over 200 homes in the region's east. The Australian Bushfire Building Conference was started. The event aims to better equip Blue Mountains residents with the techniques and technology needed to safeguard their properties. These range from expert talks to a trade show showcasing the latest fire safety technology. Dr. Douglas Brown is a bushfire architecture expert. He's speaking at this year's conference and is currently co-authoring a book to help redefine how homes are built in bushfire-prone areas, which he says is long overdue.
The issue is this. We take a suburban home, we put it into a bushland setting, and we say we're going to improve the level of fire protection of various components. But that's not enough. We need to do more. We need to say we actually need to design differently. We might need to have homes in bushland settings which are partly underground or have earth coming halfway up the wall as a protection. So how a building will look in the future in bushfire-prone areas is likely to be different.
Donald Scheel with that story. And if you want to know more about this story, head to Australia Wide's webpage. You can see Donald's online piece there.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. Prostate cancer and sex. It's not something we typically talk about, but it's the focus of a program run out of regional Victoria. While it's helping thousands of men and their partners revitalise their sex lives, it's being run by a single nurse who covers an area stretching from Ballarat, more than 250 kilometres west to the South Australian border. Dominic Cansdale reports.
For the 20,000 men diagnosed with prostate cancer every year, specialist nurses like Gay Corbett become a mentor in dealing with the disease. But there's one area Gay thinks doesn't get enough attention.
And one of the interventions that I run for men with prostate cancer is a workshop called When Prostate Cancer Joins You in the Bedroom.
That means sex and sexual dysfunction.
There is certainly fatigue, there is loss of erections, there is a loss of ability to ejaculate, and it is the threat to self-esteem and it is the threat to self-image.
Gay has thousands of men on her books and demand for her services is only growing. She's the only prostate cancer specialist nurse for the Grampians region in Victoria, an area that takes in 48,000 square kilometres.
Each year in this region there's about 180 men diagnosed with prostate cancer. However, I started 5 years ago, but I'm also looking at men that were diagnosed 10 10 years ago and they've come in contact with me. So I have, you know, I like to say I've got a black book with a lot of men's names in it, a little black book.
According to the Prostate Cancer Foundation of Australia, there are 51 specialist nurses working across the country right now. By comparison, there are around 200,000 men living with the disease.
Many of them will have ongoing concerns associated with their diagnosis and may still be in contact and need the support of that prostate cancer specialist nurse.
That's Anne Savage, spokesperson for the Prostate Cancer Foundation of Australia.
You know, the burden of prostate cancer on our community is huge and should not be underestimated.
95% of men diagnosed will survive past the first 5 years. To address this growing demand, the federal government announced almost $17.4 million in this year's budget for the provision of 34 additional specialist nurses. Ms. Savage says that's a good start, but more needs to be done.
Look, I'm not sure that at the moment it'll ever be enough. If you look at the number of new cases being diagnosed each year, you know, it's a unique disease because we have an ageing and an increasing population in Australia. And survival rates, the good news is, survival rates are extremely high. But what that does mean is that we do have a growing, rapidly growing footprint of survivors.
As for what regional areas will get how many nurses, Ms. Savage says the details are still being worked out.
We certainly have seen demand growing in regional areas with increased emphasis on the need for telehealth services and specialist nurses who are supporting us with the delivery in those, but as yet we haven't confirmed where the new nurses will be located, and that's again a process of consultation and engagement, making sure that we understand exactly what the needs are, looking at the evidence and figuring out what we need to do.
In the meantime, Gay Corbett says there are high hopes, even for men experiencing the worst side effects of prostate cancer.
The great thing is there are strategies that men can use and employ and their partners to navigate their way through erectile dysfunction and help with their sexual well-being.
But in terms of her workload, Gay is hoping that help is just over the horizon.
Hoping that there'll be a lot of help soon. There's certainly great need for it, and it's great that there's me here, but it would certainly be better if we could get a couple of more prostate nurses, especially to cover the whole region.
Prostate cancer specialist nurse ending that report. Her name, I don't actually have her name, I do apologise. Ending that report from Dominique Kansdale.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
A common struggle for Aboriginal elders everywhere is how to make their language and culture appealing to young people who are to learn it and carry it on. In the small town of Kempsey in New South Wales, 8-year-old Shailen Smith has become the new face of reclaiming the Dangaddy language after starring in a short video for ABC Me. Wiria Satti, who was behind making that film, spoke to Dangaddy elders Robert Smith and Carolyn Bradshaw about what they're doing to bring the language into everyday use again, starting with the kids.
Yeah, why? Dangaddy, why Shailen? I live in Dangaddy Land and I'm a Dangaddy girl. My pop loves telling Dangaddy stories to me.
What's that mountain over there?
Dangaddy name is Barobarai.
He likes to teach me new Dangaddy words.
Balu!
And I like gymnastics.
Robert Smith is Shailen's great-grandfather and works at Melville High School as the Student Learning Support Officer, finding ways to engage kids and teens in relearning their language.
And when you insert a bit of fun with it, like almost a sing-along, the kids get really enthusiastic and they get into it and they seem to retain that information.
We created a little hello song so the little kids can learn, you know, the word for hello and how are you, and how to say their name. So this is my name, and then thank you and goodbye. So, you know, just a couple of little words trying to get the kids to learn.
Yo, I wonder nan yinda, dangu nyue Caroline, marinbu balu.
It's when they get older is when other contributing factors impact upon that learning. You have these other influences like social media in particular, and there are other social issues out within the community where those young people have to more or less fit in with others and so on, and may be ridiculed for one reason or another. That annoys me because I try to tell them, you know, your language is who you are. before white men arrived here and gave us the title Aborigines. That was a Latin word. We were identified by the language we spoke.
In recent history, Aboriginal people were prohibited from speaking their language. But in the late 1960s and 70s, elders did recordings with some linguists, seeing the importance of keeping the language alive.
So it's just a whole heap of collections, and we're very, very lucky that they did them, because otherwise we would have nothing.
Carolyn Bradshaw, who has been working with revitalising her language for 26 years now, has relied on these old recordings done with linguists, as well as other documents such as police records.
Like, there was other documents and that, but like from police, when, you know, when they'd pick up people and they had to sort of work out what they were saying, because I was speaking in language, so they'd have to record what they were saying, so they'd be writing it down, but writing it in Dungari, the way they thought.
Working with the Dungari community, she has been collecting some of the dreaming stories from elders and putting them together in creative ways to engage the young kids.
So what we did was to appeal to the younger kids, we did a set of books with three stories each in them, and a set of colouring in books as well. And Frank McLeod, who is another Dungari person, we try to make it all Dungari. So he did all the illustrations. He also had a go at doing animation for the younger kids. And he also doing language, and Bob reading the stories in English. And Bob actually singing the Gorgon song, which is the Praying Mantis song. And the Praying Mantis is the totem of our people. So.
Gorgon, 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 Gorgundaga. Gorgon, 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 Gorgon.
But it's in the teenage years where they seem to disengage with learning the language. The elders of Kempsey have found a sure way to continue this learning process with language and culture on country.
Making sure you incorporate the culture when you're doing the language is another good way. So bringing in, like, the dancing, like, and getting them to actually learn language. When we were doing bush tucker or bush medicines, they would chuck in the language words, making spears and making tools, incorporating the language. It's a fun way to do it. So you're doing it on country. You're showing them where to get the stuff from. You're telling them the stories around that country, and then you're giving them language on top of it. So, you know, there it all is in one big pile.
As the language was being taught to all students in the class, non-Indigenous kids were often the keenest students. And while it's a great way to break down the barriers, Ms. Bradshaw felt the Dungari kids should learn their language first.
It was really important for me that our Koori kids, you know, learn first, because it gives them a lot of self-confidence. And when they're sitting in a class, if they know a little bit more about their own culture, about their own language, it just empowers them that little bit more, and they're willing to share then with other kids.
The future of language, I think, rests with this generation. There is an issue about who should be teaching our language. And we've always maintained that those who teach our language should be Dungari. How you assess non-Indigenous people for teaching our language is another issue. Because I also believe that that could hold the key to our language being maintained. The maintenance of our language is everybody's business, to coin a little phrase that's been around a while. It's everybody's business.
Wiria Sati with that story.
ABC Australia Wide.
Trixie Oldfield joins me now in the studio. There's been some angry scenes in the Midwest of Western Australia today, Trix.
Yes, that's right. Tensions have flared in Geraldton today, 400 kilometres north of Perth, after a 29-year-old Aboriginal woman was shot by a police officer yesterday evening and later died. Protesters were outside the police station today.
A mother been taken from his child, man. You ever realised that or what?
They sent all these black policemen out here to do their job. Why? They never shot that girl. It wasn't a black policeman. It was a white policeman. So why are they sending black policemen to see all the people that are thing carrying on about it? They should come out and face the black families themselves.
And today police met with the woman's family and also Aboriginal leaders. They offered condolences to the family and also said they were supporting them and the police officer involved in the shooting. Commander of Regional WA Police, Alan Morton, addressed the crowd this afternoon in a press conference.
I don't have any real concern of rioting overnight.
In fact, I'll be doing everything, we will be doing everything possible to ensure that we work with the community to reassure them and reduce the risk of anything public disorder. And we are adequately resourced and have contingencies to ensure the safety and security and welfare of the greater Geraldton Midwest Gascoyne.
Alan Morton in Geraldton. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.